The Senate Committee on Human Services will come to order. It is Monday, February 13th. If you have your cell phone on, please turn it not just to silent, but to off. Let's start with the public hearings and come back when our members are here for the work sessions.
Turn it off your cell phone.
Oh, you're turning. Good job.
No.
All right, we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 58.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 58 permits the long-term care ombudsman or designee to represent a resident of a residential facility in a contested case hearing. It renames the Residential Facilities Advisory Committee to Residential Ombudsman and Public Guardianship Advisory Board. It declares emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you. Fred Steele and Tony Larson, please.
Good afternoon. Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, member of the committee. My name is Fred Steele. I'm the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman and Director of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. With me today is Tony Larson, our State Residential Facilities Ombudsman, who is housed in our office as well with our three programs. And thank you for the opportunity to discuss Senate Bill 58 with you. And what we're trying to accomplish with that bill. It is something that we have requested through the governor's office process. It is an agency bill, and hoping to be able to answer any questions that you may have. The bill is trying to accomplish three things primarily, one of which, and probably the most substantive, that we're going to be asking to amend out as of last week with a conversation with Department of Justice. That first thing is in Section 1 of the bill in Senate 58, which was intended to open the door for our office as ombudsman programs to be able to assist a resident of a long-term care facility or a residential facility in a hearing, an administrative hearing, in front of an administrative law judge. Currently, and at least in practice for the last few decades, the practice would be is that we could assist a resident, advocate for them right up until the point where they were what we contend would be most vulnerable in front of an administrative law judge, frequently for evictions. And for the long-term care ombudsman program, that is our number one complaint. And an issue that we address, involuntary move-outs is the other term for that. Residents will frequently be able to get an attorney. We'll work with them to try to get a legal aid attorney if they can't afford an attorney. But if they can't, they have to represent themselves. For our concerns, the ones that we're most concerned with are those with diminished capacity, maybe from a traumatic brain injury, definitely those in dementia with our 185 plus endorsed memory care facilities, as well as anybody with dementia in other assisted living residential care nursing facilities. For the residential facility ombudsman programs, definitely a majority or potential majority of residents with diminished capacity that would probably have difficulty in representing themselves in front of an administrative law judge. Why the provider or the caregivers should have been doing some better personal support planning for the individual and putting in better supports for the individual, rather than evicting them or forcing and compelling them to move. With that said, as of last week and in the last couple weeks, had been in consultation with Department of Justice in previous years, including last year, as I started at shortly after I'd started at the Ombudsman Program, and as I understand it, even 3-4 years ago, Department of Justice had informed us that we would not be able to assist a resident. But with this legislation, I don't know if it was creativity, but now there's an existing provision and statute that we will be able to utilize with some passage of an administrative rule that we will work with them on to be able to accomplish what we were trying to accomplish in Section 1 of the bill. So spent a little more time on that than I intended, but that it was the most substantive.
But bottom line is you're amending that out?
Yes.
So it won't be there anymore?
Yes. That is the plan. So, but it was the most substantive portion of the bill, and so I was trying to explain, just in case there were any questions, why that is. The other two portions of the bill at least broadly, and also a very substantive portion of it for the Residential Facility Ombudsman Program, and that's one of the reasons Tony is here, just in case there are any questions, make sure we can answer those. Want to be able to create more clarity in statute for the Residential Facility Ombudsman Program, and particularly the advocacy that they're providing in residential homes for individuals with developmental disabilities or with the mental health diagnoses. The needs in some ways are just different, and want to be able to recognize that advocacy for those populations in statute, but even more importantly, and we touched on it in this introduced bill, but also going to be asking for some amended language that, since the program really started rolling out in July, in getting in homes, providing the advocacy, which was about 2 weeks after we had to submit this introduced language, even through legislative council, recognizing the need to take what's in the Federal Older Americans Act for the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program and create clarity in state statute that those provisions, in particular around investigatory and access to resident records, do and should apply to the Residential Facility Ombudsman Program. So there is some functional aspects that within the introduced legislation touches on. We're hoping through an amendment including that removing Section 1 to be able to create some more clarity for the Residential Facility Ombudsman Program in Oregon statute. Finally, the last thing that it does in multiple sections, which you'll see, is our advisory committee, what is currently called the Residential Facilities Advisory Committee. They're asking for a name change. We're doing that through this legislation. When they used to be called the Long-Term Care Advisory Committee for almost 25 years, when it was just the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. With the addition in 2013 of the Residential Facility Ombudsman Program, their name changed. About 9 months later, or even less than that, the Public Guardian Program was added to the agency, but they didn't go through a name change. I don't know the full reasons for that, but they definitely want to be able to acknowledge that they're an advisory body to the Public Guardian Program, too, and so you'll see that in this bill. Beyond that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Are there any questions?
Yeah, Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you very much. The necessity of this lengthy name change, and my question, I guess, really is the necessity, and why is it an emergency that we have to do it immediately? Are you going to have to write rules for this? Follow-up. You're going to have to write rules for this?
Chair Gilser, Senator Olson, I'll take your first question, which is the need for the emergency clause.
Right.
Wasn't related so much to the advisory body change, but more for the first two components of the bill, if we were keeping that. So we're amending out Section 1, but even still with the Residential Facility Ombudsman access to records, investigatory authority, we do feel that that is an emergency, that we would want to have the authority to investigate appropriately for the individuals and advocate for them in residential facilities upon passage of the bill. For the name change, that wouldn't be an emergency other than it goes along with the bill. As far as the rule change, I guess I'm trying to
if I could clarify.
Please.
If you need to write rules to institute what you've done, if we do this as an emergency clause so it starts effectively, the rules won't be in place. So if we set it off for 91 days, that gives you 3 months to write rules so that everything is in order, so there's no confusion. I still don't quite understand the need for the emergency. You said that was due to Section 2?
Let me double-check here with the legislation. Maybe Tony, if you want to jump in.
Yeah. Chair Gelser, Senator Olson. The residential.
We need your name. I'm sorry.
Oh, Tony, can you?
Sorry, Tony Larson.
We know who you are, but.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Residential Facility Ombudsman. So the Residential Facility Ombudsman Program opened in July, and so the clarifications to our section are pretty significant for the immediate delivery. They have impact on what we're doing right now. And Residential Facility Ombudsman Program would move immediately to put in Oregon Administrative Rule as well, which helps us specifically in the houses that we're opening now and assisting folks. So that's under that, it would be an immediate need to do that since we're already out there offering.
And Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, I wanted to find the specific provision that's currently in the introduced form. It's in Section 4 of the bill, Subsection 2, and the bottom language. What it, you know, it's talking about if needed to investigate a complaint and what it goes on to with the bold language. What we're trying to accomplish with this language, even though this even needs to be tweaked a little bit to best reflect what we're trying to accomplish. But an individual that doesn't have the capacity, a resident that doesn't have the capacity to consent to records, because as ombudsman programs, we're the voice of residents, and we defer to their decision-making, including, yes, I want you to investigate this. Yes, you can have access to my records. Otherwise, we don't have access to the records. But for residents that don't have the capacity to consent, we need to create clarity in the law that we can still have access to their records to best advocate for them, to best address concerns that they have with resident rights. Because they may still be able to address a concern to us, but if there's any even documentation in their health record, in their file at the facility or in a medical record somewhere that they don't have the capacity enough to consent, it could call into question an investigation that we would conduct. So we would want this, you know, emergency in place. Now, as far as how that relates to rulemaking, we would amend our rule, but if we have the statutory authority, then we can still act on that. For the Residential Facility Ombudsman Program, we've been waiting as it's been rolling out again since July of last year and making plans for administrative rules, but been relying on the statute to guide the implementation of that program to date. I hope that helps answer the emergency clause question.
Did you want to add?
Yes, if I can add on to that. Sure. The Older Americans Act was updated as of July 1st of 2016, and it has two significant areas in there in order for the Ombudsman Office to serve individuals that cannot effectively communicate. And that went live July 1st of 2016. And while the Ombudsman Office is operating under that, we need the language to reflect here, really, to make it clear to folks and be able to operate with the Oregon Administrative Rule. It was very significant in those areas, the update regarding investigations and being able to communicate with folks and pursuing information that was there, even if somebody couldn't communicate.
Okay, follow up. If this bill were not to pass, would you still be able to do everything you do now with your old name? Or are there things in here that give you specific more authority than you had under your other name?
Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, the current language would make it very difficult for us to carry out investigations, particularly in the Residential Facility Ombudsman Program, for probably over half of the population served by that program. And that provision in particular is one of the most important pieces of this legislation with the removal of Section 1. So we would carry out our work the way we do currently, but we would not be able to fully advocate for residents potentially over half of the residents, anybody with diminished capacity, and that includes the growing population of dementia, residents with dementia in long-term care facilities.
Before this bill, did you have the authority to do everything you're talking about? Is this an expansion of your authority?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson.
Let me ask a question to help clarify. Did your authority change after the changes in the Older Americans Act on July 1st that created this issue around the consent for people with diminished capacity?
Chair Gelser, and then even with Vice Chair Olson's question, there were changes in the Americans Act that created similar clarities that aren't clarified in state statute. But again, for the Residential Facility Ombudsman Program in particular, around individuals with diminished capacity to consent, it would be a lot easier and a lot not easier. I feel that we need the clarity in state statute to be able to conduct the investigations that we need to conduct for resident rights issues. So if there's medication problems, potential abuse and neglect, and so Chair Gelser, to your question, there was a lot more clarity provided in the federal law that changed last year, in that the Ombudsman Program needs to address even abuse and neglect situations if the resident doesn't consent to us. sending those over to Adult Protective Services. The Ombudsman Program is not a mandatory reporter and not allowed to be a mandatory reporter under federal law, which was something that was clarified. Yeah, that's the right reaction. And given that, and the reason why is because we are the voice of the resident and work with the resident. So if a resident doesn't want us to report an abuse or neglect situation because there is fear of retaliation, retribution, whether that's just perceived or real, it exists. And they want us to be able to address that and be able to fully investigate and work with those residents. And this type of a provision would be significant for, again, particularly the residential facility Ombudsman Program.
And we're close to out of time for this bill. Are there further questions on this one? No, seeing none. Any final comments?
No.
No? All right. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 58? All right. Seeing, and so you're working on amendments.
Yes.
And do you have a note for those, or do you want to work with Matt to,
yeah, was,
to get the amendments that...
Yes, I was going to be working with either you or Matt to seek that note to get those amendments in.
So, Matt, will you work with
with Appreciate that.
To get those
Thank
done?
You.
Great.
Great.
Thank you very much. And with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 58. And let's move back quickly to our work sessions. First, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 17.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 17 removes the requirement that superintendents of state hospitals and certain Department of Corrections institutions designate chief medical officers of that institution, declares emergency, and is effective on passage. There is a statement of no fiscal impact and a statement of no revenue impact on the bill, and there are no amendments.
Thank you. We heard this bill on Wednesday. Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Gelser, I move Senate Bill 17 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 17 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I think Senator Denver ought to carry.
It has not passed yet.
Oh. Is there any discussion on the merits of the bill? Are there any objections? No, seeing none, so ordered. Representative Dembrough, would you like to carry the bill?
That would be Senator Dembrough.
Senator, who did I call you?
Representative.
Okay, Senator Dembrough, would you like to carry the bill, please?
It would be an honor for me to be so assigned, Madam Chair.
I have a job.
Wonderful. Okay, I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 17, opening up a work session on Senate Bill 397.
Chair Gelser, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments. Do we have a date on those Dash 1 amendments?
We don't, since there's only 1-1, I don't think we have to do the date.
Yeah. If there's another one, there's usually a dash 2.
Yeah.
I just wanted the date on the amendment so we knew when it was dated.
All right. I will find
it. But we don't have to do that.
No, we can get it for you. That's important. It's coming.
My apologies, Senator.
The Dash 1 amendment is dated. Oh, that's the date it was uploaded. It is dated 2/6/17 at the request of Senator Steiner Hayward, at the request of the Judicial Department.
Excellent. I move we approve that.
Okay. Senator Olson moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, so ordered. Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Gelser, I move Senate Bill 397 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 397 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. The motion moves on and it doesn't need a carrier because it's going to Ways and Means. All right, closing the work session on Senate Bill 397 and opening up a work session on Senate Bill 243. Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Gelser, I moved to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated 1/26/2017.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated 1/26/2017. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the Dash 1 amendment? Seeing none, so ordered. Vice Chair Olson.
We're going to go to the Dash 3 now?
Mm-hmm.
Chair Gelser, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendment dated 2/1/2017.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendment dated 2/1/2017. Is there any discussion on the Dash 3? Is there any objection to the Dash 3? Seeing none, so ordered. Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Gilstrap, I move to adopt the dash 4 amendment dated 2/3/2017. Is this bill that bad that
we have to keep fixing? We just want to get everybody's fixes in there.
I got you.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the dash 4 amendment dated 2/3/2017. Is there any discussion?
Is there I would just ask the question, did you know of all these amendments?
Yes.
Okay.
This is the one that says that involuntary seclusion does not include timeout in an unlocked place.
Excellent.
Okay. Is there any objection to the dash 4? Seeing none, so ordered. Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Gilstrap, I move Senate Bill 243 as amended with Amendment 1, 3, and 4 to the floor where they do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 243 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And the bill moves on to Ways and Means.
Madam Chair, would you explain why the bill is going to Ways and Means?
Yes, the bill is going to Ways and Means because it is going to cost some money. And it needs to go to Ways and Means so that we can pay for it. It will be a split between general funds and federal funds, and will cover its limited duration positions in order to train folks to make sure that everybody understands the definition.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for that clarification.
You are very welcome, and many thanks to the department for working on this. Did I misspeak?
Is that okay? I already read it.
All right. All right. With that, I am closing the work session on Senate Bill 243. And opening up a public hearing on, oops, we don't need that, Senate Bill 59, so we can bring Fred and Tony back up, because they had so much fun last time.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 59 authorizes the long-term care ombudsman to petition for protective orders upon a belief that the person in long-term care facility or residential facility is in need of protective services. The measure establishes notice requirements, and it limits the disclosure of minimum personal health information reasonably necessary to prevent imminent health or safety threat. It declares emergency and is effective on passage.
Welcome back.
Thank you. And
you have to tell us who you are again, because
yes.
It's been so long, we forgot.
So again, for the record, I'm Fred Steele, the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman, Director of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and up here with me is Toni Larson, our State Residential Facilities Ombudsman, who, if we have any questions, that she'll be helpful in answering. She'll introduce herself as well. I assume that's the protocol,
that's
at least
protocol.
As I understand. So, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, thanks again for having us here today to talk about our next bill, Senate Bill 59. These are two of our three agency bills. The other third one is not in front of this committee when and if that gets heard. But Senate Bill 59 is two pages of new language for the most part, but really trying to accomplish something very simple, which is to allow our program as the state, as the long-term care ombudsman, a residential facility ombudsman programs, to be able to go directly to a probate court if we have a concern over a guardian or conservator, and particularly around resident rights issues. So there's existing statute for adult protective services that was created and passed in 2009. And has been in place for abuse and neglect situations. The same with that legislation, a lot of it revolves around the confidential information and protecting that confidential information of the individual when it's being shared with the courts. Currently, if most information is shared in a probate hearing, it's public record. We want to be able to create mechanisms, and through this legislation, we'll be able to create that mechanism to share or protect that information. The other issue with us attempting to share information is that courts will frequently, as I understand it, with one of the pushbacks we've received, is concerned about ex parte communication of any information that we're sharing with them. So specifically, information that we would share with them when there's not an open public hearing. So scenario is we have a resident of a long-term care facility or a residential facility. Typically what we do now is if they have enough capacity, even though they have a guardian or even a conservator, that they have a concern themselves themselves, we will encourage them to even write a letter to the court and explain that they have concerns. The court has ultimate jurisdiction over all guardianships and conservatorships. We want them to be able to go to the court directly. But again, for those without, you know, those with diminished capacity, which we will see frequently with the residential facility ombudsman, as well as our long-term care ombudsman, with our growing population of dementia, not to mention those with traumatic brain injury, that we have a barrier to be able to share information with the court now. So if it's abuse or neglect, we'll send it to Adult Protective Services. They can investigate and utilize their authority. But if it's not abuse or neglect, if it's a resident rights issues, a resident rights issue that doesn't rise to the level of abuse or neglect, those rights can continue to be violated by a guardian or conservator, and we may know about it but can't share the information. We have a case currently that it's been 7 months through the Residential Facility Ombudsman Program, but we haven't been able to do anything, and the rights of the individual are continually being violated. And until the court has currently, unless somebody else petitions for a protective proceeding and a protective order of some form, and the court opens up a hearing, there's no mechanism to really share the information directly with the court. So that's the long and short of what we're asking for through this legislation, is that mechanism. Now, with that said, also working on an amendment. In the past 2 weeks, I've heard back from a probate judge that I've worked with frequently over the years with some recommended changes, Department of Human Services, Aging People with Disabilities Program, as well as the Oregon Healthcare Association with recommended changes. And so we're going to be working with those individuals, those parties, and others that may have some concerns about the way the language is drafted, to try to narrow it down as needed to make it apply just again so we can be able to share that information with the courts and let the courts intervene in a guardianship conservatorship case that there may be a concern. So with that, I will ask if there are any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions, Senator Dimbrough?
I do. Thanks, Madam Chair. I very much applaud what you're doing here, Fred. For clarity's sake, could you give us an example of where a resident's rights might be violated? What are some typical, hopefully these are not typical, you know, for all residents, but what would be, you know, a kind of typical example where you might need to petition the court for something like this?
Chair Gelser, Senator Dimbrough, thank you for the question. A typical scenario would be, again, not abuse or neglect, but we have a guardian or conservator that is serving more in what's called a best interest function, and they think that they're doing things for the individual in the best interest of that individual. So they might be instructing a care facility to put restrictions on the individual, not allow them to engage in activities that they'd want to engage in, or that that the individual would otherwise be engaged in, not allowing them to have locks on their door, access to certain foods, the same rights all of us have to ignore doctor's orders maybe on certain things. They want salt or they want sugar even though they're diabetic. The individual should have the right if they have that ability to make their decisions. So some of this is sounding fairly minor, but it for an individual, it can be the most important things for them in their day-to-day lives. And we just want to be able to help facilitate that information sharing with the court as needed. I don't know if you want to add to that, Tony.
Please. Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee.
Will you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Tony Larson, Residential Facility Ombudsman. Some of the recent examples that we've had of individuals that have actually approached us for help have been impact on their day-to-day lives and making decisions. So where I get to work, whether I have a cell phone or not, people being blocked from my cell phone, being tracked via GPS. Without my knowledge, having my clothing limited and who I interact with, individuals wanting to function as independently as possible and having decisions made that are outside of a limited guardianship capacity. We have a really good system in Oregon for the front end of guardianship when that's being applied to, and individuals have the opportunity, goes through a few different processes, but Disability Rights Oregon, for example, for developmental disabilities and mental health will receive those notices. But once that process has taken place and a guardianship has taken hold, what we found in these individuals that have approached us is that without having access to their own money, without being able to move, they can't actually seek assistance. Unfortunately, the great systems of legal aid is very limited in what they can take in what area, so they may or may not have access to that. And Disability Rights Oregon as well. So this really takes place after those processes have happened, and individuals are kind of tied in one area and can't get another look. And this is really a request to be able to knock on the door to trigger processes that are already there, whether that be a visitor process or a court being able to appoint an attorney on behalf of the person. So it's the ability to just open the door and say, this is what's being reported or this is what we see. And they need access at this point to having a second look at it. And we have had several of those cases since July.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 59? And Fred, again, you'll work with Matt on the amendments.
Wonderful, thank you.
That you need. Great, yes. Thank you so much. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 59 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 275.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 275 permits covered entities to deny or charge a fee for additional copies of personally identifiable health information requested by the appellant or the appellant's representative in actions to appeal a denial of Social Security disability benefits. It permits covered entities to otherwise deny copies of records to requesters that are not the subject patient or the patient's representative, absent proper authorization from the patient, and to charge for such records with proper authorization. It declares emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you. And let's start with Courtney Dresser and Mark Bonanna. And I know the bill is actually going to look very different than what it looks like right now. And you can maybe explain that.
Sure.
And I also want to apologize. We will bring this bill back again. The folks who are planning to come today have been attacked by the crud that is plaguing so many Oregonians right now and are unable to speak today, literally.
Good afternoon. Courtney Dresser for the Oregon Medical Association, and thank you for hearing this very quickly, and we'll come back when we have the proper amendment. So we appreciate the opportunity to kind of share some of the experiences that our clinics are having in implementing Senate Bill 710. And as a reminder, 710 was something that this committee passed out in 2015. First, our members and their staff are very supportive of the patient's right to access these records. In regards to the goal of, in that regard, I think the goal of both the attorneys and the doctors are at the same level, and that's we want the patients to get the information they need and to get all the benefits that they deserve. To better achieve that outcome, what we had hoped to happen in Senate Bill 275 was that we could verify the clinic records, that clarify the time that was requested, and that it would be done by the guardian or the healthcare representative. Both of these are the intent of 710, but it wasn't very clear in 710. So what we wanted to add was that they would provide the information that was created after the date of the initial denial and before the date of the appeals hearing, free of charge to the individual or the individual's guardian or healthcare representative. So with that, we would be able to define the time frame from which the records may be sought for the purpose of the disability claim and clearly identify who may obtain the record. It's important to understand that providers must abide by HIPAA, which is something we all hear about all the time, but it is very important for providers. HIPAA states that a personal representative is a person that can make healthcare decisions on behalf of that patient. And also HIPAA violations do come with monetary citations for healthcare providers if they don't comply. So again, we're looking to clarify just those two pieces. Senate Bill 275 came out a little bit different than we had intended. So we're hoping with a different amendment, we might be able to get to a place of that everybody would be comfortable. And again, we are not seeking to not provide these records. We're just asking that we do it within the legislative intent of 710.
And just a quick clarifying question. I know we talked about this on the phone the other day. If the amendment that you've talked about, which is a lot fewer words than what are in this one, were to pass, the attorney would still be able to create the form for the individual. That individual would sign the form. They could mail the form. They could designate that the materials be mailed back to that attorney's office.
Yes, I checked in on that, and that is probably how it would most likely work, and probably how it works oftentimes. And it's important for the provider. They would probably still verify with the patient just to be safe, but it is important for the patient to know that their information is going to this person and that this is their free request. And so, yes, I believe I think in our toolkit created a type of form that the attorneys could use. We had hoped some of this behavior would sort of kind of autocorrect itself, but it didn't quite get there, which is why we're here with this bill. And so I believe the answer is yes.
Sure, I can supplement that. Sure. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Mark Bonanno, Oregon Medical Association's general counsel. Again, we're here to try and do something that would just kind of codify, I guess, the legislative intent, legislative history of Senate Bill 710 from 2015 session. We thought it was clear that personal representative back then did not include the individual's attorney. And what we've found over the past couple of years is that we field quite a few phone calls from our members in their clinics. And, you know, as you can imagine, a clinic manager is very busy, and they're telling us that an attorney is calling them, threatening them, and it can be a very intimidating process for them. They want to do right by their patient. And, you know, again, we thought Senate Bill 710 clarified that. We're here to just correct that. And again, we don't want to have clinic managers having to put themselves in between their patients and their patient's attorney trying to resolve this. So
we look forward to seeing the amendment.
Okay. Are there questions for the panel? Seeing none, thank you both very much.
Yeah.
Next, we have Scott Sell and Tina Martin, please.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Senator Scott Sell. I'm an attorney who represents individual disabled people applying for Social Security benefits in Portland. In that capacity, I regularly help clients invoke the benefits of what was formerly Senate Bill 710, now codified as ORS 192-576. In my firm alone, that statute has helped hundreds of individuals obtain medical records. These individuals are often of limited means. Those records are vital in obtaining federal disability benefits, and in turn, those federal benefits reduce the burden on the state. I'd like to just give you a brief overview of how my office uses the statute to access those records, and then I'd like to introduce Tina Martin, who's a former client of my firm, and she'd like to talk just a little bit about how that statute benefited her. In my practice, this is the process that we follow. I invite the clients to complete a statement invoking the statute and requesting that the records be delivered to my office on their behalf. My office sends the statement along with the various HIPAA releases to the medical records provider. My office tracks the medical records requested and then follows up on aged requests. My office responds to invoices that we receive that erroneously state that the patient owes money for the records, and my office submits those records to the Social Security Administration. That procedure outlined above is effective and efficient for both the claimant and the medical record provider, and I understand that even with the proposed amendments, that procedure would not be affected by Senate Bill 275. I would answer any questions you might have before introducing Tina Martin.
Any questions for Scott? Seeing none. Ms. Martin.
Hi, my name is Tina Martin.
Maybe I'll just give a quick introduction. By way of introduction, Tina recently obtained Social Security benefits, represented by another attorney at my firm. Tina is from Oregon. She grew up in Corbett. She went to Corbett High School and graduated through their special education program. She worked for 17 years in a laundry. And after she developed some trouble breathing and some trouble with her hands, she sought out Social Security benefits, and we helped her obtain her medical records.
Thank you for passing the law that allowed me to get free medical records. Without that law, I don't think I would have been able to get Social Security. I haven't been working for a while, so I couldn't afford to buy my medical records. Even if I had the money, I would have not known who to ask to get my medical records. Also, I wouldn't have been able to keep track of my medical records after they were sent to me. My lawyer helped me do all of these things. I'm glad she did it, because without her help, the law would have been no use to me.
Thank you. And I just want to ask a clarifying question. It sounds like if the amendment comes back the way that we expect, this change would still allow you to do the work that you're doing for your clients and for Ms. Martin to still have been able to get her records as well. Is that?
That's my understanding, Senator. Our primary concern is just that we be able to use the procedure I outlined above. And if that procedure remains intact, yes, Senator.
Thank you. Are there other questions? No. Thank you so much, Ms. Martin, for coming. Sometimes it's hard to come in and tell a story, especially in a room like this, but that's what we're here for, to do this work, and I hope you come back again. It's really important to hear from
you.
Can
I say something else real quick?
Of course.
My lawyer was a very good attorney, and when she told me that she would help me get the medical records, and when I said, how do I go about it? And she said, I will take care of it. It was like a breath of fresh air, because I couldn't have been able to do it without her. So,
well, I'm glad that worked, and I'm glad we were able to create a law that made that possible, and that we'll be able to clean it up a little bit so it can stay around to help a lot more people move forward.
Oh, yes,
forward.
Because a lot of people do need it, and it really helps. Because when you apply for benefits, you don't have anything. You have no benefits, you have nothing. So that law would really help a lot of people.
Exactly. Well, thank you so very much.
And thank you, Senator. I'd just like to submit our testimony to your legislative assistant.
That sounds great.
Testimony.
And it'll be on OLIS. Thank you. Thank you. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 275? All right. And we will have this come back to us once we get the amendment. Right. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 275 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 95.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 95 requires certain securities professionals to report suspected financial exploitation of elderly, disabled, or vulnerable individuals to the Department of Consumer and Business Services or the Department of Human Services. It permits securities professionals to notify third parties previously designated by victim of suspected financial exploitation. The measure permits securities professionals to delay disbursements of accounts and provide notice if professional reasonably believes that disbursement may result in financial exploitation. And it also establishes penalties.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I may make a correction to our administrator.
Okay.
He said report to the Department of Consumer and Business Services or the Department of Human Services, and the summary says and.
Oh, my apologies.
So I want to be clear on that.
My apologies, Senator.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both. With that,
you're listening, aren't you?
Way to go, everybody. Okay, Victoria Blackley, David Gillis, and Charlie White, please. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
And you've probably caught the routine here. You come up and introduce yourself for the record. Each of you for yourselves.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and committee members. My name is Victoria Blatchley. I'm an attorney from Portland, Oregon, and I'm here with two of my clients today, Charlie White and David Gillis.
Welcome.
So I am a trust and estate litigator. I have 20 years experience licensed in Washington and Oregon. I represent individual trustees, corporate trustees, beneficiaries, and personal representatives, often in difficult and challenging cases, including trust and estate litigation, will contests, trust disputes, undue influence, capacity, fiduciary breach, financial elder abuse, and contested guardianships and conservatorship cases, or as I like to call it, drama litigation. I'm an Oregon Super Lawyers for Trust and Estate Litigation, and that's an award available to only 5% of Oregon lawyers who have attained a high degree of peer recognition and professional achievement. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 95, which requires certain securities professionals to report suspected financial exploitation of elderly, disabled, or vulnerable Oregonians. It allows them options to freeze accounts and report concerns to the Department of Consumer and Business Services and the Department of Human Services. In my law practice, I regularly come across difficult stories where horrible people take advantage of some of our most vulnerable citizens. And these stories often involve greedy family members hiding behind documents that may appear legal on their face. Indeed, two of my clients are here today to share part of their story, David Gillis and his wife, Charlie White. Mr. Gillis and Mrs. White saw firsthand how quickly a family member can try to take control of an aging family member for inappropriate goals. Specifically, their case involved their beloved aunt and one of the nephews, their cousin, took extraordinary measures to take control of her life over her objections, and he sought to isolate her and control all of her finances. Fortunately, she had a long-time relationship with an investment advisor that was helpful in putting the brakes on his plan long enough for lawyers to be retained and the entire project to be shut down cold. A subsequent hearing resulted in a detailed order that affirmed that the bad actor had no good intentions and the aunt and her considerable resources were protected. But what I think they would also tell you is that it is an incredibly difficult thing for a family to keep their eyes peeled at all times for such behavior, and that the efforts of anyone to look out for their aunt was greatly appreciated, be it a bank teller, investment advisor, or anyone else that came into contact with her. In my practice, I will say that it truly does take a village to keep our vulnerable Oregonians safe, and I believe Senate Bill 95 is another tool to help accomplish that goal. Through my securities law colleagues at my firm, I understand this issue, keeping elders safe, has been on the forefront of NASA, the North American Securities Administrators Association, and FINRA, Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, and proposals for uniform legislation have been making their way around the United States. Oregon has also been progressive in identifying mandatory reporters for elder abuse, adding new categories on a fairly regular basis. While neither investment advisors nor bankers are on that list, and what I'm talking about is ORS 125-050-9, Senate Bill 95 does provide a good start. It addresses the problem when an investment advisor is given a document that appears to be legal, like a power of attorney or a trust, but if the investment advisor knows that capacity or undue influence may be involved, Senate Bill 95 gives them the ability to take action contrary to what the fiduciary with that document may be telling them for the protection of the vulnerable person. I will note that I have seen an amendment to the proposed bill that fixes one unintended issue, and I'll bring that out briefly. I do not believe it has been reduced by legislative counsel to an actual amendment at this point, but I need to point it out today for my testimony. Specifically, Section 1, Sub 3, Sub B, in defining financial exploitation, includes the act of a conservator to when converting assets or deprive ownerships. So, but it is the court-appointed conservator's duty, obligation, and legal requirement that they need to take control of assets and put them into the conservatorship's name. So they would necessarily be taken out of the individual's name. So the way as it currently is written, it would include a conservator taking legal action as it being a wrongful taking. So the proposed amendment I saw just goes to the definition of financial exploitation as it is used in 124.0504, and so that eliminates that unintended consequence. Accordingly, I support Senate Bill 95 as amended. I'm also a commissioner for the Oregon Commission on Senior Services, and I can report to you that the commission has voted and is in support of Senate Bill 95. Finally, because I am a strong advocate for the protection of vulnerable adults, I want to leave you with this excellent resource, and including everybody in the room. The toll-free number for the Oregon Elder Abuse Hotline is 1-855-503-7233. I encourage everybody here in this room that's behind me, I'm a mother, I have eyes in the back of my head, to put that in their cell phone. Again, it's 1-855-503-SAFE. And you can put that in whatever materials you use for your constituents, and I encourage you to get that resource out. Oregon's had it in place for a couple years now, and it's an excellent resource. Elder abuse thrives in secrecy, silence, and shame, and the more of us that keep an eye out for abuse, the better. And Senate Bill 95 helps shed a little more light. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and committee, my name is Charlie White, and I'm here with my husband, David Gillis, to testify in support of Senate Bill 95. Our elderly aunt signed a revocable living trust with her nephew, our cousin, as successor trustee and gave him power of attorney in early 2014. She never transferred her assets into that trust. At the end of that year, 2014, our aunt called us and gave us her car because the doctor told her not to drive. It was at this point that she began having trouble with her nephew, the newly appointed successor trustee. When he learned she had given us her car, he promptly took her to the hospital for some leg issues and some slight memory loss after a long cruise she had taken. The nephew was able to get a dementia diagnosis after a single visit and with only his information provided to the doctor. Once he had the diagnosis in hand, per the trust, he was able to reroute all of her mail to his address, took away access to all her bank accounts and investments and statements, and canceled two checks she wrote to an attorney for representation. Soon thereafter, per only his testimony, her nephew was able to portray her as depressed, even suicidal, and convinced her doctor that she needed psych meds, two different kinds on two different occasions. First, Zoloft, then months later, Risperdal, were prescribed without her knowledge. She said they made her feel funny, so she soon refused to take any of her medications, compromising her health. The nephew's depiction of her new tendencies required that her pharmaceuticals be administered by the retirement home nursing staff, which were now entering her apartment twice a day, thereby invading her privacy. She didn't like it. At the time, our aunt was 90 years old, never married, and accumulated a sizable estate. Fortunately for her, she has a long history with an ethical financial advisor, who is also a longtime friend of the family. When pressed by the new trustee, he was concerned that she had never transferred her investments to the trust, so he put a hold on them. Though through our extensive and costly litigation to get her nephew removed from the trust and out of our aunt's life, we are now happy to say she has an independent and reliable trustee, and our sister is her guardian. Through the deposition process, we found that her nephew was in the process of attempting to move her assets out of state into accounts of his choosing. No one in the family knew all this was going on and would have believed the story as told by the nephew had she not called us for help in early 2015. Because of our involvement in witnessing her distress and learning some history of our cousin after a bit of sleuthing on our parts, we were able to show family members the truth of the situation. Had she not called us when she did, he would have gotten away with it. Now, after over two very traumatizing years for our aunt, her health is better, but some memory decline, is able to take her own pills. Our sister sets up a pill minder. has her privacy and her mail is restored, her accounts are safe, and has resumed her previous private happy regimen. Our aunt was more fortunate than many because we believe something has to be done to protect all vulnerable elders. We think Senate Bill 95 is a good start. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Are there any questions for Senator Olson?
Thank you very much. In reading the bill, it states that if someone determines or has reason to believe that there would be some type of nefarious actions going on, it says that they must report the identity of all persons that the qualified individual believes are responsible for this suspected or attempted financial exploitation. My question to you as a lawyer, could that be turned against that person that if he doesn't know all the people in regard to the fact that he was supposed to report all persons that the qualified individual believes, and if he doesn't, could this law be used to prosecute him and fine him the $2,000 for not providing information on all people?
Senator Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, this is akin to mandatory reporting, that it's good. You have to have good faith and reasonable cause. So if you suspect that there's exploitation going on, your job is not to be the judge, juror, and executioner. It's to provide whatever information you have at that time to the professionals so that they can delve into that. So you are not expected to do your own investigation about all the parties that may be involved, all the information. Your obligation is to get the information that you have at hand to the appropriate resources. So hope that answers your question.
A follow-up. So what you're telling me then is that they would, if they didn't provide all the names, they would still be immune from prosecution on this?
Senator Gelser, Senator Olson, again, it goes back, the Senate Bill 95 itself does have immunity if you are acting in good faith.
Okay. Just want that on the record.
Are there further questions for this panel? Senator Dimbrough.
I do. Thanks, Madam Chair. So actually going back to the original point that Senator Olson made with the reading of the summary of the statement of the bill, this calls for reporting to both DCBS and Department of Human Services. Do you know why both?
Senator Gelser, Senator Dimbrough, I do not know the answer to that question.
Okay.
And we do have DCBS coming later that
Great.
We'll be able to address that question.
Thank you.
Senator Montes Anderson.
I think that it probably should be, if DCBS is coming up, the question there, I was wondering how this was in compliance with federal law. And I also had a question regarding securities professionals and whether the firm that the securities professional were in was also, would be held accountable also.
Senator Gelser, Senator Anderson, that probably would be a question that's going to be better addressed by someone with more expertise in the security area than myself. There are definitions within the statute itself that refers to other statute in defining who would or wouldn't be liable. So I think that's the starting position for you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any further questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you all very much. And
thank you. And I do have our written comments that I'll submit as well.
Wonderful. And thank you for coming forward to share your story. Appreciate it. Next up, we have John Powell, Elise Brown, and Roger Beyer. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. Today here in support of the goal and the concept behind Senate Bill 95, but opposed to the bill as currently written because of a couple technical issues and one pretty big substantive issues. So I'll get right to it. On the technical side, I think there's some work that needs to be done around the definition of who would be an eligible person. Right now, I think it is a little broad and includes in a person with a disability as defined in ORS 124.005, which includes somebody that has any kind of physical or mental impairment which substantially limits their life activities, which could be high blood pressure, diabetes, something of that nature that is clearly not intended to be reached in this bill. So that's the first technical issue. The second technical issue is found in sections 3, 5, and 7 of the bill. These are the sections that deal with the immunity provisions for reporting such an instance. It states that the individual reporting would not be liable under state law. We think that's potentially ambiguous. Questions of whether state law would include administrative rules, whether state law would include the outcome of a court decision. So we would suggest changing that language to be more inclusive and maybe not as broad, but we think better worded, and should be changed to be immune from criminal, administrative, and civil liability. And we think that would cover it. Now to the substantive issue. The bill seeks to place mandatory reporting requirements on behalf of financial advisors and representatives, which may sound fine. The concern comes when you look at the opposite of that. If somebody, even in good faith, does not report, there is no immunity provision. So the immunity provision is only if one reports. So taken at its worst, this could set up a system that could overburden DCBS and DHS, where individuals are reporting anything that could possibly be seen as financial exploitation, even if they don't think it is, because there is immunity for doing that. But if you get caught not doing that, potentially it could be a case of per se negligence even. So that is a big concern. We think that could be solved by changing one word from shall to may, which would still create this system for reporting and have it be permissive for financial advisors to make that decision and not mandatory, which would do away with what we think could be a perverse incentive to over-report. If the mandatory method is the way the committee wants to go, we would suggest that there would have to be or need to be a safe harbor both for good faith reporting and good faith non-reporting. So those would be our suggestions. Thank you to the committee and DCBS and DHS for bringing this up. It is indeed a problem that's going to get bigger as the population ages.
Thank you very much. Elise.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, Elise Brown for CIFMA. CIFMA is the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. I appreciate the opportunity to offer comments on Senate Bill 95, which creates a process for additional measures to protect senior, disabled, and vulnerable individuals. CIFMA has been a long vocal advocate in the fight against financial exploitation of our seniors and vulnerable clients for nearly a decade. And therefore, we were pleased to answer the call by DFR and Mr. Blackwell to participate in an interim work group discussion, which was last fall in 2016. At that time, we suggested waiting for SEC-approved rules to come out, which we knew were imminent, nothing by the end of the year. But in fact, federal rules were approved just this month, February 3rd. Which allowed for a 16-month rulemaking process with changes along the way. So the rules are here. They'll be published in the Federal Register shortly, and soon broker-dealers across Oregon and the rest of the country will have access to that. My ask today is two things for your consideration. Number one, since we've got the rules now, everybody's going to see them, let's let the federal rules play out. Because as we see this today, and you've seen the language that CIFMA has submitted to all of you, that there are conflicts with federal rules. The second consideration for you would be at least to consider the language. allow us to sync up with the federal rules and give us a little more time with the department to work through that language to see if we can come up with something that is lines up exactly with what the federal rules are. Reasons being that when jurisdictions pass regulations, there's practical consequences. And we have to look at what 50 states are going to do with FINRA and SEC rules. If everybody came up with something different, it becomes a nightmare to manage. So this is why we're urging for the state to coordinate with federal rules. In the end, we all want the same thing. We all want to protect seniors and eliminate fraud and catch the bad guys. We believe it's best achieved if we can all agree to the best approach that allows the industry to follow a standard process and then train to that process. So again, our hope to be able to sit down and spend a little more time with the department to see if we can sync up with what federal rules are already established. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Roger.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer, here representing NAFA, which is the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, the Oregon chapter. You have my written testimony pointing out some, I guess I would agree with Mr. Powell that there is a one policy question and then probably some technicalities if when you get past the policy question. So NAFA's position is this should be a voluntary reporting bill. We agree with the goal. No one wants to see financial exploitation. Our members are on the forefront. Our members will be the qualified individuals called for in this bill. But we think that creates some problems for them in their relationships with their clients and in their outside their company. So the bill, in our eyes, should be a voluntary bill that creates an easy reporting system to DCBS. The training should be provided to persons seeking a license before they can get their license on financial exploitation. Training to detect and report, how to detect and report financial exploitation should be part of ongoing licensure. And I understand security advisors don't necessarily have CE requirements, but insurance producers do. And many insurance producers, annuities are considered financial products and annuities qualify under this legislation. So we think there's an opportunity for training and continuing training through the CE requirements, where every licensure has to attain 24 hours of CE annually. We think you've heard about potential rules, potential problems with the federal rules, and then also companies could be required to do the reporting rather than the qualified individuals. That would work through the FINRA process, as we understand how it's going to be, where it's the companies that are going to be required to do the reporting, not the individuals. If the bill is going to remain a mandatory reporting bill, we think there are some problems, and I've already mentioned two of them, and that's in training and ongoing training. So if that scenario, we believe if you're going to pass a mandatory bill, you need to delay implementation for at least 2 years to allow for the qualified individuals to get the proper training before they're subject to any fines. And finally, we also have to be concerned about the rules. That'd be another federal rules. That'd be another reason to delay implementation of a mandatory bill. I won't go through all the details of my written testimony on the technical problems that we see in the bill, but there's another one that I forgot to mention in my written testimony. I'd like to point it out because the speaker before us brought up Section 1.3 sub B. It says any act or omission by a person is what. And then you goes into an A and a B, what's covered in those acts or omissions. Well, one of those is the benefit of the money. So if a financial advisor recommends a plan, which is an act, that then proves to have a lower rate of return than a different plan that they may have offered, would that be an act that results in a loss of benefit to a client? It could be, as I read this draft. I don't think that's what's intended, but that's what is potential under some of the language in this draft. The other thing that I need to point out is that as we read this draft, with the dual reporting requirement, our agents or qualified individuals could be subject to two civil penalty violations for every failure to report, because they are required to report to both DCBS and DHS. I don't know if that's what's intended. It's unclear, but I believe that's what it's drafted. And if that's the case, that seems to be a double jeopardy for the same omission or non-report. We believe the bill needs, if you're going to keep a mandatory bill, reporting needs to be reported to a single agency. Let the agencies speak to each other. Our preference would be the report would go to DCBS. That's where our brokers and dealers are licensed through. They have no relationship with DHS. We believe DCBS should be required to create some sort of a written reporting requirement or portal or something, because we don't want it to be that oral reports are allowed. There are no records of oral reports, or voicemails can get lost and never responded to. So we believe that DCBS should be the single agency. Let the two agencies talk to each other. Let them deal with who needs, where the reports need to go once they are filed. But we don't believe that it would be considered good government to require citizens to report the same information to two separate agencies and then be subject to civil penalties from either or both agencies if something goes awry. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to respond to any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions, Senator Olson? And then Senator Ambrose.
Thank you. Just a hypothetical. Assuming you have an elderly person in your care, and they arbitrarily sign checks and give them to a relative or a family member, and the person watching the money sees these checks go out, would they be liable under this for not reporting it as taking advantage of the elderly, or would it be difficult for them, without the proper training, as you talked about, to determine that, in fact, this is a something that the person wanted to sign the check and give the money out? How could a financial advisor differentiate between what would be a legal gift and perhaps exploitation?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I guess thank you for that question. I believe it was directed to me.
Well, I was looking at you, Roger, but so, anyone wants that, I can.
That's a concern we have, is that if a person is, with the consent of the elder person, taking advantage of the family member, but it's with the consent of the elder or disabled person, would that require reporting if a financial advisor sees that? As we read this bill, and like Mr. Powell said, this bill will lead to a vast amount of over-reporting potentially because of that exact situation where you have immunity, if drafted correctly, for reporting, but you have no immunity. In fact, you get penalized if you don't report. So I believe that under the language of this bill, that would require reports. And what my clients have told me is that what that creates is conflicts between financial advisors and their clients, and ultimately the financial advisors are the ones that are the losers in that.
Thank you.
Senator Dimbrough.
Thank you. I'm sympathetic to some of the calls for some of the technical changes that have been made, and certainly for the need to phase this in a way that it leaves enough time for training and awareness building and perhaps, professional development opportunities for people to understand what their obligation is. Overall, I think that this bill is moving in the right direction in that we've been doing this for attorneys for a while, right? Attorneys have had an obligation as mandatory reporters when they see instances of financial exploitation. And this really seems comparable to me the kind of situation that an attorney might find her or himself in and a financial advisor might find her or himself in. And so, given that we have, committed to taking this step for attorneys, where is there a difference which would suggest that we should not be doing this for fiduciary professionals?
Senator Dimbrough, I could take a stab at that. As an attorney, from your first year in law school to your last year to studying for the bar exam, you are trained to recognize what's called undue influence. You are trained to, take classes on elder abuse. And finally, through the attorney continuing legal education process, we are required to take at least, I think it's 1 hour of a CLE class on mandatory reporting. So there is kind of a buildup and a training Whereas for a financial advisor, right now, there isn't that kind of training model out there. So I, if you're looking for a difference, I would say that would be one of the differences. And again, we're not saying that we don't want a system for reporting these sorts of things. We're just saying that, you know, I think that there should be some kind of safe harbor as long as the person is acting in good faith, whether they report or good faith not disclose, so that you don't get a skewed view.
So just to follow up, Madam Chair, John, do you know if there is such a safe harbor for attorneys? I mean, for you, if you're acting, you know, come across such an instance.
That's a good question, and there would always be that good faith standard. So your standard is that if you are in good faith making a report, you would be in a safe harbor. I would also think that it would be easier for an attorney to argue, given the training, that they would have in good faith not disclosed something, or at least make that argument. And I think most attorneys would come into this situation where there is the potential for financial exploitation less than a financial advisor, where in just about every transaction in which they're involved in, there's that potential if the customer is, you know, over age 65. That would be my best shot at that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
All right, last up we have Cheryl Hemstra, Laura Kelly Robinson, and Aaron Teverbaum.
That's all right.
Yeah. Okay. Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laura Callie Robison, and I'm the administrator for the Division of Financial Regulation with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And if it's okay with the committee, we agreed that DCBS would maybe go first so we can go back through some of the highlights of the bill and hopefully address some of the concerns that we've heard raised. So I think in the interest of time, I think you've heard some, agreement about what we're trying to accomplish here in keeping seniors and vulnerable people safe from financial exploitation. So I, without going into specific stories, I think it's really important to underscore really the scope and breadth of this issue. The size of our senior citizen population is continuing to grow. The assets that our senior citizens hold are vast, and so they're prime targets for this type of exploitation. We're probably going to talk a little bit more, I imagine, about the difference between mandatory and voluntary reporting, but one of, I think, the center points in this bill's focus on mandatory reporting is that financial exploitation is severely underreported. It does constitute a significant portion of abuse claims that are investigated and substantiated, but there still is a pretty strong belief and strong evidence that this is underreported. And so we believe that mandatory reporting is really a key piece of this to help us get a better handle on this, prevent exploitation before it occurs, or curb it after it's begun. So I wanted to talk a little bit just about the process to get here in terms of developing this bill. I think you heard a little bit from some of our other stakeholders about the bill, but it is a bill that's brought before you by DCBS, but it's based on model legislation that's been through an extensive public process through the North American. We belong to so many regulatory associations. North American Securities Administrator Association, and really a lot of the issues that you've heard discussed today have been discussed through that process. We've also brought together stakeholders from other state agencies, from both the consumer and the investment advisor perspective, to talk through this issue as well. And we will talk through some of the more details of how the bill is intended to work. But I did want to highlight that a number of the areas for adjustment are things that are already on our radar screen. So the definition of eligible persons is something that we're already working to clean up, and I think in line with the comments that we received about aligning that with the existing definition, alignment with the federal rules that are that have been recently adopted. We think we're pretty much we're pretty close to that, but if there are areas that we need to adjust, we are willing to talk with stakeholders to make sure that we've made those adjustments appropriately. There was discussion of the safe harbor. We believe that the bill is constructed to provide that safe harbor, both between the definition of or the use of the reasonable person concept, and then also the immunity from if someone's acting in good faith when making a report. The dual reporting issue is something that we have been talking with DHS about, and we think that there's a really important aspect of having both agencies know about this issue so that DHS can be doing its investigation in terms of protecting seniors, and that we also can be sure that we're seeing what's happening on the security side. But I think it might be helpful for the committee to understand a little bit about the process and how we're planning to resolve some of these issues, particularly as it relates to the mandatory reporting and some of the alignment issues with federal law. So I'm joined by Erin Tieverbaugh, who's a senior policy analyst with the division. I'm going to ask her to walk through a few of those.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Erin Tieverbaugh. I'm a senior policy analyst for the Division of Financial Regulation inside the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I've been working with the NASA Model Act to try with the stakeholders and to try and bring this into a legislative concept that works with Oregon law. One of the first things we did was look at NASA's process, and they went through a process through 2015 and then part of 2016 where they worked with some of the same stakeholders that you've seen here that we've been working with as well. They received a number of comments over that period of time, one of which, how is this is going to work with FINRA's regulations. FINRA is the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. They regulate primarily broker-dealers at the firm level, also investment advisors. FINRA had their rules at the same time that NASA was working theirs through. And so part of something that we were watching is FINRA and NASA kind of come together on reporting timelines, and one has a safe harbor and the other has immunities. And they were FINRA's rules were published in the Federal Register on the 9th, and so they actually have been out there for public comment. They should kick in between, I believe, 6 months and a year. FINRA regulates individual member firms, and FINRA's rules are specifically to get at how broker-dealers should behave in certain situations. So they're requiring good faith efforts to try and get a contact information, a trusted contact information that could be notified in the case of a reasonable suspicion of financial abuse. FINRA also provides a safe harbor from regulatory actions if the broker-dealer or FINRA member were to take action to delay disbursements. And that works really well with what NASA has done. So what NASA did was require broker-dealers, investment advisors, generally through a qualified individual, which could be somebody who is in their compliance or regulatory or in a legal capacity with a firm, to report when there's a reasonable belief that exploitation of a vulnerable person is happening. Mr. Kelly had mentioned that we're trying to work to align our definition of vulnerable person with DHS's current vulnerable person definition so that we're not creating confusion in that. The mandatory reporting is dual in the NASA Model Act, and that is in part to get at the different types of regulatory systems that you're touching with this type of abuse. One is the security side, where we have the expertise to look at broker-dealers and investment advisors, how they're dealing with their client records, what it is that they're doing, whether or not they themselves or a member of their firm might be involved in it. And then on the other side of it, you've got the Department of Human Services, which is really the expert in investigating cases of abuse. So that's why the dual structure was set up. I know that was a question that had come up earlier, is to make sure that the the instance or the reasonable suspicion is covered on both ends. DCBS doesn't have any more expertise to investigate financial exploitation than SIFMA had brought up or NAPA had brought up, but DHS does. And so that's one of the reasons why they're looped into the reporting structure. The bill also allows, the NASA Model Act also allows for the contacting a previously designated trusted third party in the case that there is a suspicion of elder abuse, so that there's somebody else in there that the advisor, the broker-dealer can talk to about what they see going on to determine whether or not this is a case of permission or gift or just sort of an unusual behavior or something that the financial or the client really is intending to do and is fully aware of the consequences of, or whether there may be something going on that is tantamount to fraud, essentially. The Model Act and, again, the bill that we've introduced doesn't allow to report to a trusted third party or a pre-designated third party in the instance that the financial advisor thinks that that person is the person who's trying to exploit or attempting to exploit. The NASA Model Act allows for a delay of disbursement, but it's only disbursements. So it's not a situation where you've got a financial institution where somebody's coming in and taking out money directly from a depository account. This is disbursements from a securities account. So it's not trades, it's not anything other than disbursements. During the comment period with NASA, they decided that they were going to keep it very limited to just disbursements, and so that they weren't running afoul of other federal requirements for turning around sales or annuities or things like that. So it is a very narrow hold that applies. And the hold applies for the same level of time under the NASA Act as it does under the FINRA Act. So it would be an initial 15-day delay. If you're going to delay, you have to notify the account holders, unless one of the persons holding the account is suspected of the abuse, within 2 days. And then if there's cause, that can be extended for another 10 days. But both the FINRA and the NASA Model Act have those same timelines in it. And then it provides immunities for disclosing account information to a trusted third party, immunities for the hold, and immunities for record sharing, which is really an important part of the bill to make sure that DHS has the ability to access the types of financial records that they can use to address cases of financial exploitation.
Thank you.
And Chair Gelser, I think one final point to make, too, is the comment about training. It's something that, you know, is not contemplated currently in the bill that's before you, but something that we're certainly open to working with stakeholders on. I think with any new requirement, appropriate training is really helpful, I think, for it to be effective. But we're happy to answer any questions that you or the committee may have.
Great. And we have just a couple minutes left, so I want to go ahead and move to questions. Senator Denbrough.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just going back to that question of the dual agencies again, I understand that in some situations DHS really would be preferable to DCBS and not in others, but if we want to keep this as simple as possible for the reporters, couldn't you set up a system where, there would be an automatic referral to the other agency or automatic notification, but that you'd only have to make one call?
Chair Gelser, Senator Denbrough, thank you for your question. And we have explored whether there's a way to have it go to one agency and then have that agency report over to the other agency. That's something that we're still open to working on. But the concern that's led us to the dual reporting is that if that reporting comes to us first at DCBS, you know, we're focused on the really kind of investigating the security side of things. And if for some reason there were something to fall through the cracks to not get that reporting over to DHS, could there be a delay in kind of protecting someone who might be subject to kind of broader abuse? You could argue kind of the same situation if there was kind of a temporal delay in making that report. But I think that with an effective communication system between the two agencies, we can clear that up. But so we've been working with DHS all along on this bill, and I think that we'll continue to work with them to see if we can find a path to make that more straightforward, but still make sure that we're both getting timely information.
I think I would really want to see you come back with something like that, just as something can fall through the cracks between the agencies, expecting that mandatory reporter to, one, have the reasonable cause to make that call once, and then to make the call the second time seems like a pretty high burden to put on the reporter.
Chair Gelser, we're happy to work on that further with DHS.
Thank you. Senator Olson?
Thank you. In reviewing this, I noticed the qualified individual was a salesperson, and then you refer to the salesperson as defined in ORS 59015. Well, that's a salesperson for securities. So my question to you is, how many, I assume there are quite a few, but how many elderly folks have securities and annuities? And how many, what's that percentage compared to the elderly folks that just have a savings account, a bank account, and maybe some passbook accounts, or which aren't apparently covered by this bill?
Do you want to take that, Karen? Chair Gelser, Senator Olson,
I can't tell you off the top of my head how many persons under 65 or that would fall within the definition of vulnerable persons have securities or annuities versus how many have bank accounts. We went through a transitional period not all that long ago that we're still kind of struggling with, where most people no longer doing their retirement savings through a pension plan at work, but are actually actively involved in sometimes managing their own IRAs or individual retirement accounts of whatever denomination. And so more and more people are actively invested sort of through investment advisors or broker-dealers and the salespersons. The salespersons under this with regard to the securities personnel are those people who are really kind of the front line in the state for broker-dealers. So it is those securities people who are dealing with the retirement accounts that really are having more and more of a frontline impact on vulnerable persons and persons over 65.
Follow-up. So DCBS doesn't really have any idea what the population looks like of those people that have stocks and bonds and annuities and those people that don't, because I think this pile of people over here is quite extensive that don't have stocks and bonds, and they also could be open for exploitation, but this bill doesn't cover it.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson. So I think we can get back to you to see if we have any information that might help us understand kind of the division of assets held between the two different types of accounts, or the kind of the, investments versus bank accounts and other depository accounts. But we do note that often banks are they are noticing this activity, and when they do they're often reporting on this as well. But from what we understand, there is really a significant amount of wealth, and often this is these are the accounts where many people have placed their wealth that they plan to be able to use in their later years, and so that's why we have focused on this, and that's really been the focus of the model that we've built upon, which was coming out of the securities regulators and focusing on that.
The only thing that disturbs me is you didn't focus on the entire population, only
the rich.
Thank you. Or those people that have greater means.
Right. Are there any further questions? We're just at about time. I'm seeing none. Thank you very much. So your next steps, you're going to continue working with the department. Yes?
Madam Chair, actually, we're not all together.
Oh, you're not all together. I'm so sorry. I thought you were all together.
Chair Gelser, Cheryl Heemster, Deputy Legislative Director, Department of Justice. We support this bill. Sounds like there's going to be some technical fixes coming up. But, elder abuse is a priority of our Attorney General, and we just wanted to lend our support. We are part of the working group. And if I may, Senator Olson, there is a House bill, House Bill 2622, dealing with banks on this issue. So that may be coming your way.
2622. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you all very much, and maybe we'll check back in offline in a week or two and see where we're at in terms of getting amendments drafted to get this moving forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you all very much. With that, we are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 95. And just quickly, we are a small committee of five. So if you know you're going to be testifying, if you could let me know maybe by the morning so we can...
I did let you know.
Okay, and I think it just didn't get to me. But if we could, just so that we have more than two people in the committee, because we had like 15 minutes.
If you're scolding, don't scold me.
You're, and I'm not scolding anyone. Just there's only five of us, so let's.
Because both Denbro and I had a very important bill, and it took a long time to testify. But I did send it to you.
Right. And then maybe Matt, if you could send to me right away, that would be helpful because we can delay the hearing or.
Well, or you can do the public hearings first.
That's what I do.
Not
with just two of us.
Oh, just
we
two.
We were only two people.
Yeah.
Until 1:15. So. All right. With that, we are adjourned. All right. With that.